Tatsa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tatsa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamatasa Tavara Ye Sotavanta Bamunjantu Sadhan. So this is the one pra, or the observance night, and we have 1 month left of this winter's retreat. This, I've been on retreat now since the after the first week in February, and that nearly 3 weeks has been an extremely appreciated time to just not have any kind of duties or responsibilities. You can imagine somebody in my position with endless kind of things that one has to do or be responsible for, talk to people, or instruct, teach, lead, when whatever, and then suddenly all that is don't have to do any of it. So I stayed in the kuti most of the time. Venerable Bunyasar being over my meals and so forth, so this was very peaceful time. Then this, of course, this awareness practice, developing this awareness, it doesn't stop no matter in terms of the conditions that you're experiencing, whether it's being alone or in a group or on retreat or not on retreat or whatever. This is not these are not the things that we're trying to arrange or attach to. Not a matter of trying to have things in a certain way in order for me to be mindful, which is, you know, not missing the point completely, because nothing that we can experience precludes mindfulness. So whether it's pleasant or painful or what we like or we don't like, want or don't want, it's the way it is. So the point is the awareness, rather than the being caught up in one's reactions, emotional reactions to the condition. So one thing it's easy for us to imagine, you know, like in a monastic life or monastic community, or we can form opinions about how they should be. We might have examples of how we think good monasteries are, and then compare the existing conditions with our ideal. But mindfulness is being able to see what we're doing. We're actually, you know, attaching to some ideal we have of monastic life, and then comparing how we're experiencing the present one with the ideal. So the awareness allows us to see this trap of the mind, you know, how we can believe our own views and opinions and our own reactions to something, and give that our attention, become attached to it, and then feel very negative, or be caught in negativity or aversion or resentment or whatever, without being aware of what we're actually doing, what's actually happening for us. So we can easily blame the conditions, or the people involved, or the place that we're in. That's how the worldly mind operates. We seem to identify our suffering with things not being the way they should be, or not being what we want, or not being according to our what we're used to or what we believe in. So Buddha's teaching is, remember the awakening, the wake up practice. So when we chant the mantra Bhutto, the Bhutto is another way of saying wake up. So waking up is like switching on the floodlights, and we are aware. Or you might be lost in your own kind of views and opinions and feelings and memories and so forth. As soon as you turn on the switch on the light, isn't it? It's awareness of this, like this. It's like in the present moment, there can be many things, you know, many, many factors all at once. Many different things happening all at one moment. Well, a mindfulness, sati sampajanya, allows us to be aware of this present moment as it is, with all its various factors or conditions that are happening. Where when we don't do that, then we get caught into taking a viewpoint, having a view about something, and then holding to that view and regarding anything that doesn't quite agree with it as being wrong, or we can see ourselves as being wrong, or the place we're in, or the people we're living with, or whatever. We can believe in our own sense of what's right and wrong. You don't have to be mindful to be attached to right and wrong. You're conditioned to do so. So like cultural conditioning is what we get in regards to how we should be, what a good boy is, a good girl. Girls are like this, boys are like this. Good boys, good girls, and how good girls should be, good boys should be, good sons and daughters, good citizens of the society, what bad boys and girls are, and bad sons and daughters, and bad citizens. Now, we find these are very much what we get from our culture. So I was reading about this in Kalimantan. Where the Dayaks, the kind of native tribal people, have been butchering the immigrants from Madurai, from one of the other parts of Indonesia. And of course, part of the Dayak culture of the old times is headhunting. And so they'd cut off the heads. And this was culturally still pretty much, I guess, approved of within their value system, and yet to us it's horrific, isn't it? It's barbaric. Of course, I've lived in, had very 2 years lived in Sabah, which is north Borneo, and a very pleasant time there. And these tribal people are usually extremely nice people. My memories of, I didn't live in Dayak areas, but in areas that I lived in, the part of the Sabbath I lived in was on the East Coast, and they were called Bajaus, the tribal people. And they were Muslims, and they had, they were mainly, lived on the sea. And the Bajau tribes live in the southern Philippines, in like in around Mindanao and that, and then in the area of Sabah that I lived in. All these very dark skinned people that lived mostly were fishermen, they built their villages, which they called kampongs. They built them out over the sea. And many of them just lived in boats. So they'd have, remember, I used to go fishing with them. Some of the boys would take me out fishing, and they had these round, kind of rounded boats, long, narrow, almost like canoes with round bottoms. And these boys could kind of jump around and leap, they'd often dug in on a coral reef. They'd pole over these reefs, and then they could see fish. They'd see all kinds of things. I couldn't possibly see anything. And some of these boys were so skilled they could dive down to the water and catch a fish with their bare hands. Where I'd just move slightly and the whole boat would just rock like I felt like an elephant in a canoe. and yet these boys were extremely, felt completely at ease and secure and natural in these boats out on the water. Anything dealing with the water out on the sea. But then, as they moved on land, their sense of confidence would diminish. They say some of them felt very insecure when they had to live on land. They had to go to school, riding bicycles, things like this. Because you are conditioned according to your culture, what you get from your social background, your parents, your identities, the conditions that influence your life are very, especially the early years are very powerful, very real for us. So it's easy to, and then of course I remember in Sabah where we lived, the Bajaus were the, there was one kampong called, they have names like Bangau Bangau. And Bangau Bangau was where the poorest of the Bajaus lived. And this is this rickety kampong. You had to walk over this long kind of catwalk, which it wasn't very well made, and it had like boards in various places. Some of these boards were missing, some were rotten. And they weren't into maintenance like we are here at Amravati, or into kind of calling in the carpenter or the whatever to repair the catwalk or the kampong. It was just a very rickety place that some people, like Western, like other Peace Corps people, would come, and I'd take them out to Bangau Bangau. Some would be absolutely scared to death to walk on this catwalk because it didn't look very safe. And then you go out onto the kampong, and then they have maybe 50 to 100 little huts built out over this coral reef, and children would be playing, and they didn't have any kind of like fences around or anything. They just let children crawl all over this kampong, and And nobody seemed to worry about it. The mothers, you know, weren't concerned about children falling into the water. And somehow the children learned from, you know, how to survive in such a situation from an early, you know, from the beginning. Because their expectations were such that they didn't have all the kind of anxiety around safety. And yet, you know, like if you take one of us, we'd try to take a baby out to live on that kampong, you'd be nothing but, you know, your hair would fall out from worry. So these people were also very hospitable, the Bajaus. And you'd go out and they would, you know, they'd always bring out some kind of liquor and any food or whatever. And you'd go out to various kampongs out in the islands off the coast, and they're always well received. So I saw the very good side of the Bajaus, but then I heard that if they got angry with you, you were in for it, because they could also turn suddenly very violent. Though even though their hospitality, their generosity, and their goodwill was one thing, they also had this other side, which could easily go into you know, cutting your head off, or just, you know, going crazy, going amok, as they say, completely losing it. So fortunately, I never triggered off those kind of emotional reactions. But I could understand, you know, how you know, and then we also wanted to sentimentalize, like in the, this was in the early days of the Peace Corps, American Peace Corps. So we were, you know, 1964, and we were still very new experiment, and we also romanticized native people, you know, about how natural they were and how, you know, and we would often compare them with ourselves or with our views about the Americans or the British, and then most of us were very pro-Bajau and very critical, especially of our own group. So, because we were very much aware of the flaws and the dark side of our own culture, the inadequacies of our own social background or parents or class, where on the level of romanticizing the simple life of the Bajaus was, and from what we wanted to see, we tended to not notice the dark side unless it became too apparent, you know, too obvious. So there is a way of kind of holding to ideas about the noble savage ideal of the Western mind, and the kind of primitive, the Tarzan syndrome, and how civilization is kind of destroying us, and we could, you know, build up very interesting cases to support our particular views. But in terms of Buddha Dhamma, it's switching on the light, isn't it? It's not a matter of culture, whether it's advanced or sophisticated Western or primitive or tribal or whatever. The problem is the same, really. The human ignorance does not seem to get any better through civilization. And then we can quite easily justify, you know, bombing Baghdad and places like that. But not in terms of going amok and cutting off people's heads, but of using very sophisticated weaponry to kind of annihilate something, and in the process, be responsible for the death of others. And we can have very good rationalizations and justifications for such behavior. And just as no doubt Bhajaus did for their kind of ways of reacting, of trying to destroy the enemy, or the Dayaks in Kalimantan towards the Badaris. So the Buddha, say then, is not a matter of culture or civilization, but of awakening. I think many of us have been disillusioned because in the previous century, isn't it? The kind of smugness and arrogance of European civilization, thinking it was based on such high principles and morals and all this, on Christianity, on ideals of democracy and equality, and yet we can see the whole 20th century was, a series of bloody wars and all kinds of horrendous acts were committed in the name of God or civilization or any kind of view, any way you want to justify what you're doing. You can do so through rationalization. You can always justify anything you do or want to do. But in switching on the light, then this is a way of transcending this conditioning. So we're not coming from a position anymore, from some idea that we're right and that our views are right and that our way is somehow better than somebody else's, or that our particular religion is the right one and someone else's is wrong, or that we're civilized and they're not, or we're more advanced, or we're racially superior to them, or we belong to a certain class, or the identity with being male or female, with high-minded ideas, or with just being practical and realistic, pragmatic. All these can, have their influence over how we interpret experience. But with awareness, then this is the ability to see this, to observe the feeling of the moment, the sense of our own of the arrogant emotion we might be experiencing, or our feeling of fear or anxiety, the opinions, the views that we hold to, the sense of being right and somebody else being wrong as a reality. And that when you're aware, then you can be aware of that as a particular condition that's present in this at this moment. So that's why it's this sati sampajanya, satipanya is given, is the essence of the teaching. It's pointing. It's the awakened state. Like we can be conscious, we're conscious, but still we can be operating out of, not out of being awake, but out of the momentum of habit, of our own biases, prejudices, viewpoints, emotional habits. We can justify these in all kinds of ways and defend ourselves, and we can really feel somebody else is wrong and I'm right. And there's a very strong feeling, isn't it, of when you know you're right and somebody else is wrong. And so they say, in terms of, if, even if this is true on the conventional level of me being right and you being wrong, that doesn't mean that I'm awake, isn't it? That means I can still be very attached to the sense that I'm right and you're wrong. And then what does that do is it tends to make me feel even more, you know, I've got to show you, I've got to punish you in some way, I've got to humiliate you or make you admit you're wrong or do something to you, so because that's the right thing to do. People that are wrong, that do things they shouldn't, should be punished. So we have this sense of righteousness and punishment, where the wicked should be punished for their sins, and the good ones, the saints, and the righteous ones should be rewarded for their goodness. So this is logic, isn't it? It's the kind of way of thinking that seems right. It seems terrible if the wicked were rewarded with success, happiness, praise, and all the good ones were humiliated and punished and abused. Something really distressing about that. That's not fair, is it? That goes against all our ideas of how things should be and what's fair. So we can feel when somebody's being punished for being wicked, we can feel even happy about it. They deserve it. They should be, you know, they should be humiliated. They should be punished. And made, like you can see with just this case recently about this James Bulger, this little boy that was murdered, what, 6-7 years ago, by two other little boys, and it was a kind of heartless murder where two boys kidnapped a younger little boy and murdered him. And then these two boys that did the murder were put in some kind of detention because they were still children, and now they're trying to it's time to release them from the jail. There's a lot of, the parents of the boy that was murdered are very angry about this. They feel these boys should be punished even more so. You know, they shouldn't get away with it so easily, because it seems right that, you know, we lost our little boy, our little son, and these boys are the murderers, and they should be punished, really punished for it. They should maybe never be let out of jail. They should be kept in a prison until they die at 100 years old. And they deserve it. I feel good about that. You know, that's what they deserve. And that makes me feel that there's justice and fairness in this world. But if this government's going to let them out only after 7-8 years, well, then I feel really, that's not right, and feel very angry. So now whose side is one going to take? One has various views and opinions about it. One could easily, you know, I have a mind that can understand both sides. That was one of my problems, being a layman, was I was easily convinced when a person would come up. And I'd go, oh, that's right. Then another person take the other side. And, yeah, that's true. It was very confusing to be a kind of one who could see both sides. I used to long to be the kind that had strong views and would stick to them and fight for them through thick or thin, and never, and always have a way of conquering and completely smashing down the opposite, and completely humiliating and proving the other side was totally wrong, misguided, and so forth. And I wanted to, you know, have a mind that could conquer like a warrior, a really tough tough guy that could, you know, put people in their place and never get caught in any kind of ambivalence, wavering state. So that then the awareness is our ability to switch on the floodlight, begin to see what we're actually doing. So it's not a matter of taking sides or not caring or not doing anything, but it's putting the conditioned realm that we're experiencing into a perspective of light, seeing it in the light for what it really is, rather than being caught up in the way it seems, the way it feels, the way I'm conditioned to perceive it, my biases, my prejudices that influence my reaction to this particular thing. So you can see, like, awakened awareness is getting beyond any cultural conditioning. Before cultural conditioning, or before any identification with the conditioned realm starts taking place. In the Buddhist world, isn't there? There's a lot of conflicts and views and opinions that fly about in just the Theravada. Just in Theravada, not to mention the Mahayana. And even in, you know, whether it's Bariyati Bhattibhat, whether you should study the scriptures first and then practice, or practice and then study the scriptures. or whether it's in Thailand, the Wat Ban or the Wat Ba, whether it's the village temple or the forest temple or the Tamayut or the Mahanikai or the all these different things. There's so many conditions that one can easily be attached to and identified with. And then it gets into whether a Sri Lankan or Burmese or the, you know, if you're conditioned through the Thai culture, then you have certain ways of perceiving yourself in your cultural attitudes towards, say, Cambodians or Vietnamese or Sri Lankan, Burmese, are affected through cultural conditioning. And then how one sees Christianity or Judaism or Islam, or just having views about religion in general, and some of these views can be, you know, have a sense of being right or wrong. They can be based on facts and experience. They can be very real to us, or they can be based on total delusions, biases or fears and prejudices. So in terms of headhunting, you know, that's something very much that in my cultural experience has never been an allowable option. I mean, it's a cannibalism, isn't it? These things are absolutely, you know, not allowed in terms of my cultural background. Just totally forbidden. But yet, being brought up as a dyak in Borneo, it might be considered the right thing to do under certain circumstances. And a religious act, even, or something, and it can be, and that's how one sees it, isn't it? It's how the condition of the mind operates. And then we can think, well, we're civilized and they're not, and so we can hold ourselves as superior and headhunting and cannibalism is barbaric, and hold to views about we're somehow civilized and they're not. But we're still caught in the same delusion, isn't it? The light hasn't been switched on yet. So we find even, you know, among the arrogance of the civilized people can do atrocious acts, worse than cutting off somebody's head or eating somebody, a human body. We can be quite capable of committing atrocious acts, and from being very well educated and culturally advanced, because we're still operating from ignorance, from not knowing, not the awakened state of being, but from cultural conditioning, from our own views of right and wrong. So then if that's all there is, if that's all we can manage, then it is a rather, you know, one can't help but feel quite cynical at this stage of the game. Because we've seen, you know, the sense of say, European civilization as being somehow superior, I don't think that particular perception is very strong anymore. That the white man's burden or the sense of our cultural superiority doesn't register as being something that one wants to believe in or promote, or one is even be embarrassed by it, by anyone who holds to that view. Because we can see that that's not the way it really is. That when, you know, that having a particular cultural attitude doesn't make you superior in the absolute way. So then what brings us to a place like Amravati, or to take on the life of a samana, is because of not because of trying to become, is it, but because of some kind of awakened, intuitive sense. And this is where I encourage to trust in this sense of what you're doing, what brings you here, propels you to live this life, to make commitment to this kind of life of restraint as a samana. And of course, it's not, you know, to be right and to prove ourselves Buddhism is better than the rest, or that being a monk or a nun is somehow superior to being a lay person, or in any way to try to promote ourselves or what we're doing as an end in itself, or to hold any views about it blindly, but to be able to see any views that we do have around this life, monasticism, Theravada Buddhism, our style of practice, Buddhism in Europe, Buddhism in Asia, and on like this. These can be even be views that have a lot of truth to them, but that's not the issue, is it? It's the light that allows us to see that views, even good views and right views, can lead us to do foolish and stupid things through attaching to them, through being attached to views. Views and opinions, positions. So then we can feel very threatened by that. I remember one person years ago when I was talking, they wanted to promote morality as an absolute. Absolute morality. And so I said, well, morality is relative. It's not absolute. And it created a lot of panic in this particular person. Because it sounded like I was being wishy-washy. You know, like I was trying to have an easy out for immoral actions. Because you want to take the hard line, you know. If you get moralistic, isn't it? Then, like moralism, the thing that is frightening about morality is moralism, where you attach to moral precepts that become, you know, you're attached to the precept, to the view. And then that leads to a rigidity, you know, where you lose perspective and you become very judgmental. So you can have, you know, you shouldn't drink alcoholic beverages, and then you get very attached to this idea of Sura Me Raya Machavavatatana, and then you go around really condemning everybody that drinks any kind of liquor at all. You can become a real, you know, really a pain in the neck to have around, because you're so full of your own sense of righteous, moral righteousness. Or, and I was brought up in that style, actually, it's like that. And around sexuality, things like this, isn't it? The only right way to have sex is once you're married. Then you're allowed to have sex. Is only when you're married. And if you're not married, then you shouldn't have sex at all. They say, what about masturbation? No, that's wrong. Masturbation's wrong too. That's sin. So there's no way, no allowable possibility to deal with a body that has all this energy, except to get married. And then you feel very... And you don't feel like when you're 14 years old that you want to get married. So what do? You can only feel that you're a sinner, or, either you take it in terms of feeling very dirty, or that you're doing something bad or nasty or wrong that you're going to be punished for. Or you can just say, oh, I'll chuck it in, just say, I'm going to have no more, I'm going to. Or you maybe deliberately do all the things you shouldn't as an act of rebellion. But none of these are switching on the light, are they? That's not what's happening. So switching on the light allows us to see the forces that are affecting us, the sexual desire, the cultural conditioning around it, the self identity. And it's not judging it, it's not making value judgments about any of it. It's just noticing it's like this. This is the way it is. So like in this present moment, it's the way it is now. So in terms of this, I'm aware of the sound of silence, because I've practiced with that for years. So immediately this sense of presence, pure presence, I immediately notice this. That's now, isn't it? It's happening right now. And there's awareness of the body, of the way, you know, so, and then through paying attention just to the postures, and I'm aware of this right, this left leg, which is beginning to feel slightly uncomfortable from sitting so long like this. I just suddenly notice there's the switching on the light, and then there's an awareness, isn't it? Just physical experience of just things that your body is experiencing at this moment. Or emotional state, feeling of of some kind of whatever, you know, feelings of happiness or sadness or whatever that might be present in your mind at this moment. So then awareness is not a critical judgmental function. It's the awakening to the way it is. Once we begin to trust in this, then we can deal with the pain in the leg, or the emotional experience we're having, or the fear, or the greed, or the delusion, or the doubt, or the anxiety, or the resentment, or the righteousness. So like in my own life as a Buddhist monk over the years, then having opportunities to have, you know, where the life style is this actual encouragement all the time to be in the light, to keep trusting in this light, in this awakened state. So then in terms of experience, you have various things like my early life in Wat Pa Phom, and just learning to kind of adjust and adapt and get used to and train and all that would bring up all kinds of feelings of you know, I could be very attached, I could become very critical, I could feel very rebellious against it, and I could feel very inspired, very attached. But the awakened state was to be aware of these things rather than to hold to a view that I should, well, how I should be, and then try to make myself fit into the ideal of how I should be. That's one thing I genuinely appreciated with like Lungpo Cha was, you know, he had a very kind of good monastery, but it was never, we're never encouraged to be attached or to hold the views, but to always reflect on the views that we did, that we found we were attached to. Then living here, and I've lived in England now longer than I've lived anywhere, nearly 24 years, and it's a long time for to live in one place. And so then as a Buddhist monk. So then the life here is keep learning from the experience of it, rather than thinking that at first I used to long to go back to Thailand because it was easier to be a monk in Thailand. And you felt you were respected and treated properly and all that kind of thing. And life was in one ways more easy living as a Buddhist monk in Thailand. But then seeing through that, being able to see these views with my own preferences or desires, not to judge them, not to say I should be content with where I am and I shouldn't have these desires to go someplace else, because then that's not awareness, is it? Awareness isn't judging, not saying how I should feel, just noticing that right now the feeling is like this. So if I'm feeling I want to be somewhere else right now, then if I'm coming from a judgmental position, I'd say, tomato, you should be content. Contentment and gratitude. You know, it's good enough the way it is here. Just settle down and be content and stop moaning about things. And then the tomato, I really want to go back to Thailand. Shut up. So then I can kind of make myself do it. But then the price you pay for it is that you still suffer all the time because you can kind of grin and bear it and make do with things, and still, you know, long for something else, not want it to be this way, want something that you don't have. Then in switching on the light, awareness of discontentment, not wanting things to be like this, is like this. And as I aware of not wanting it to be like this, I'm not judging, I'm just aware it's like this. It feels like this, this mood of being discontented and not wanting to be here is like this. And then what happens? It doesn't take root, does it? It doesn't, you know, it is what it is. But you're seeing it in terms of what it is rather than making it into something more than what it is. So then you begin to trust, and once you have that insight, then you trust in this simple path of awareness, because it's something you can, it's budgetang vetidapo, something that you have to know for yourself, to see for yourself. It's to trust in pure awareness also means that you, as I say, it's not critical. It's not where I find, you know, what I get confused is I would, because I had ideas of ideals about being content with what I have. The ideal of being a good bhikkhu is being content with the four requisites, no matter what they are. So whether you're living in a really poor place, under a tree, you don't even have a bamboo hut to live in, I should be content there. That's the ideal. Or people give me, not very nice food, fried frogs and dung beetles, and I should be content with that food. And then with my robes, even though they're, you know, the material's not very good and they're not very well made, I should be content with it. And on like this. And if I'm really sick, you know, I just drink fermented urine and be content with that, is the ideal. And then living here in England, for example, the standard of living is quite high. So, you know, you get content with the banquets that we have every Sunday. or whatever. We can, being content and being grateful, these are ideals. And if I start grumbling or not being content or not living up to those ideas, then I can feel quite guilty. You know, the superego says, you shouldn't feel like this. You should be content and grateful. And you shouldn't grumble. And you shouldn't complain and so forth. And you should, on and on, what should and shouldn't be. So then that is the way the mind's conditioned. And I found those ideas very attractive. You know, the idea of being content, being grateful, with the four requisites, no matter what they might be. Not grumbling, not complaining, not blaming anybody, being equanimous rather than just emotionally fraught all the time, going up and down like a yo-yo emotionally. You should be equanimous, and rather than be so angry or so greedy about things. And so then the superego jumps in and says, you should be equanimous. Look at you. You're all over the place now. You're just, you know, you go up and down like a yo-yo. You're all, just one moment you're high as a kite, and then you're ready to kill yourself. What kind of samana are you? You should be equanimous. So then the self-hatred and despair and so forth begin to, we believe that we're hopeless. Or we're not good enough, or maybe we don't have enough barami, accumulated virtue. Maybe we can't ever get enlightened in this lifetime because, you know, maybe we just don't have what it takes. That's a possibility. So then, this is how the self view operates. So then, switching on the light or awakenness allows us to see this. And so it's not criticized, it's not, there's no shoulds or shouldn'ts in regards to awakenness, is it? If you grasp the idea you should be awake, then you're not awake anymore. You're grasping the idea. It's not I should be awake, I should be mindful and go around trying to be mindful through grasping the idea. It's a simple trusting act of paying attention in the present, of opening to this present moment. So it's an imminent act. It's you can't see it. You can only be that. Then the light is on. What do you see? What do I see when the light's on? Equanimous, fine. Emotionally all over the place, that's fine. Whatever, it's the way it is. Being emotionally all over the place is like this. Or equanimity is like this. Or grumbling and complaining is like this. Or being content and grateful is like this. So, or whatever. So it's, or hating yourself for not living up to your ideals is like this. So you begin to just notice uncritically the way the all conditions are impermanent. So this is why it is simple enough, but in terms of, you know, it's an imminent act, so it's very, it's so simple, so completely simple and natural that we tend to not give it any value. I mean, many of us started out with trying to attain things, isn't it? Trying to conquer our kilesas and develop virtues and get samadhi and all this kind of thing was very much how many of us started this life is just trying to, you know, get rid of our anger and our conceit and selfishness and trying to become something, some I live up to be a really good monk and live up to these ideals, prove ourselves. But then it became apparent that doesn't work. That it's always this endless, on that level, there's always ignorance operating. So even moments where you feel you have achieved some high state, you know, you lose it too. Whatever you feel you attain, you're going to feel a loss of it. Because they go together, gain and loss. Or a pair, you get one, you've got the other along with it. So it's not a matter of achieving or gaining or attaining or becoming, but in learning to trust the sadha in this attention to the present. So offer this as a reflection for this evening.